Hey everyone, welcome back to the Gary V Audio Experience. Today's episode is an interview Gary did for Advertising Week Asia, where he discussed how brands can properly capture attention in today's marketing landscape. We hope you enjoy.
This is the Gary V Audio Experience.
Thank you so much, Gary, for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
So we're going to be discussing today how can brands capture attention in today's marketing landscape. And I think it would be really good to first discuss, when if we're talking about how to capture a user's attention, maybe it'd be useful to understand what attention actually is. You know, the attention economy is constantly shifting as platforms rise and fall, but there are some things that remain constant within that. So, Gary, when you're speaking with brands about where they can fit within the attention economy, how do you weigh up the fundamentals, which might be something like the average consumer spends 2.5 hours on social media per day, versus all the variables, which might depend on what platform's kind of hot at the moment?
It's a great question, Jess. I think the thing that really surprised me about the advertising industry when I came in about 12, 13 years ago was how and it shouldn't have surprised me, but I had the great fortune of the brands that I had built were always my businesses. And they were, and I was doing it for the long haul. And I also had nobody to judge me on it. You know, so my compassion and my empathy for a CMO trying to justify brand building in an environment where people are looking for reports and numbers to justify actions, oftentimes every 90 days, was pretty extraordinary and an interesting wake-up call. What was devastating is what has transpired through that, which is an incredible ecosystem of reporting that isn't quite practical to the actual business results. And so, you know, for me, the attention economy is based on common sense and real life human anthropology. I think one of the reasons I've been on an island oftentimes, sometimes by myself or with a small group of executives in this industry, is so much more of what I'm looking for sits in the current state of consumer behavior, more so in the historic way that it was measured through other mediums. So it's a tremendous call out. And, you know, and let's just break down Asia, right? Asia in itself is extraordinarily complicated and fascinating because China is a big enough market to be the world by itself and has a totally different ecosystem of where their attention is versus other parts of Southeast Asia. And so for me, whether it's WeChat or Line, Facebook or Instagram, TikTok or Netflix, or some other OTT provider, network TV, direct mail, you know, I view all of this like day trading. You know, I've recently gotten very active in NFT landscape. And one of the wild things about that world is the price of Ethereum and Bitcoin is always alive. You know, and Ethereum's getting smashed today on our recording. And, you know, I was saying to a friend, well, what's good about the old stock market is it closed at 4:30 and at least you can take a breath. This is a constant anxiety roller coaster at all times. But ironically, it makes me think to this question. The thing I always talk to customers about is, are we measuring sales or are we measuring brand? Number one. Number two, does your organization internally even measure new things like a TikTok or a Spotify ad or, you know, a new feature in Line or WeChat? Or because the reality is, and I think you probably know this, and definitely a lot of people that are watching here, many of the marketers are not tone deaf or checked out. They just can't spend dollars in those areas because the measurement mechanism back home hasn't taken into account these new places. And the lag, Jess, is extraordinary. And there's sometimes they'll wait too. I mean, most organizations today of the size that would be watching this do not measure TikTok properly or even begin to think about how to. And now it's been a force for years. And so, you know, the way I talk about it is, look, this is a day trading activity for me, but you're a big, big ship that's quite slow. Can we at least have this conversation that I'm having which then leads to a more realistic convo of, can they even spend in that environment and create in that environment, or can't they? And that's okay, but I think we have to get into the realism of why they don't.
Do you think that it's maybe due in part to these, there's so many platforms being going through these peaks and troughs. Are those platforms providing or equipping marketers with the tools that they need in order to measure? Or, you know, when it comes to that kind of resource and...
I think that's a tremendous point. At times, no, because they're so young. And realistically, the big elephant in the room is a lot of these platforms don't care if the biggest brands in the world are spending on them. They're doing so well in mid-market and emerging brands. So, you know, it took Nielsen ratings to be accepted a very long time. These companies are young. Even the big ones are only 15 years old, right? More importantly, and this is a very big conversation, one could argue that it's hard for the media buying agencies and the creative shops that dominate the industry to be incentivized to market in these new channels because the profitability and the margin sits in old channels.
Yeah.
You know, if you're a traditional digital media shop, it's much more fun to do black box programmatic ad buying on the digital exchange from a margin standpoint than it is to properly plan a day in and day out comms plan for Facebook and TikTok. So if the brands are not holding the agencies accountable, the agencies are not accountable to the brands, they're accountable to their stockholders, and you get this ecosystem. So I think it's a good call out, I would say at times no. At the same token, I think it's on brands stewards' responsibility to make common sense decisions. I've had hundreds, I'm one man, and I've had hundreds of conversations with brand leaders around impressions and GRPs where they make jokes about them not being real, yet that's still where they spend their money. And I think that speaks to corporate behavior, doing things that won't get you fired. And I think that that's hurt a lot of brands.
We hear this a lot, Gary, in Asia, a kind of pursuit of clicks or whatever your metric might be, without much regard as to whether the people that you're reaching are real or whether those metrics actually mean anything. You know, and there's a, that's a big conversation that has been happening in this part of the world for some time with the kind of hope to shift to more attention metrics. I want to get your point of view on how rudimentary you think the measure of attention currently is. And I'm sure this will really differ depending on who you are, where you sit within the ecosystem. But, you know, we've talked about how your point of view is kind of looking at day trading. But beyond that, beyond looking at the here and now, do you measure attention based on what a user's mental state might be or what kind of experience they're in, or how, what are the different kind of metrics that are needed in order to get to that really key measure?
The things that we, the places where we have passion that we think are practical, because I have a lot of compassion, it's so hard to measure brand. As a matter, let me take a step back. It's impossible to measure brand through math. It just is. Like, it's time that we start having that conversation with each other in this industry. Like, nobody can possibly believe that these brand lift studies or all these other things we do are actually right. They're grounded in such silly. We interviewed 1,000 people and have decided 8 billion people believe this about Coca-Cola. And I have compassion for that. I don't poke it. I surely don't have that answer. I'll tell you the two things that Vayner loves. It loves being held accountable to business results in the short term through brand work to drive sales, Jess. So let me say that. It's an interesting statement I'm making that I think is very unusual. We believe that we are cracking an interesting code at this time where we are doing brand work in social. Brand work. That is being held accountable to business results reporting. AKA, we're doing brand work for a bottled water and we're being held accountable by our client based on sales in a 1-year window at retail. And we're winning that game because we have media and creative together and so we can be held accountable. The reason we think we're winning that game is what we're measuring is sales, depletion reports at retail. And number two, Jess, we're very passionate about qualitative feedback. We think consumer feedback, the good old fashioned comments at scale, at meaningful scale, are actually an incredible indicator to sentiment. By the way, no better than interviewing 5,000 people, maybe slightly in my opinion, because a lot of people when they're being interviewed about a brand know they're being interviewed psychology-wise, whereas in social, it used to be great. Now that people know people are watching, it's changed because people are adjusting. But for us, it's business results and qualitative feedback to the sheer volume. We're very unique in the volume of creative we put out. And we use that creative as an insights tool to drive to more above the line work. So that's how we see it.
So I guess because there's a lot of discussion around whether people are their authentic selves. And if you're measuring sentiment, how do you know that you're measuring sentiment from an authentic point of view versus what someone is trying to project on social media?
We don't.
No,
nor does anybody else. But I can tell you from my 15-year experience in the 13, excuse me, in this space, as a business results indicator, social media qual feedback at scale has outperformed historical survey data at scale. So my big thing, people will say in an interview or a debate or a jam session, in this exact moment, seeing, Gary, what do you mean? Like, prove that this social works. I always say, hey, Jessica, real quick, before I do, remember your data is based on surveying. So you're dealing with it, before we even start, it's very hard to believe that, one is so much greater than the other, because it's human behavior at the end of the day. It is my belief, my continuous belief, and I have enough affirmation at this point with business results for so many clients and businesses I'm associated with, that we are still, and it's dropping, Jessica, because of the political nature and just the evolution of social media and the Social Dilemma documentary. Like, it was gold 7 years ago, Jess. People were just reacting. It is definitely, to your point, now a mechanism more of fronting or, but in the mundane of a soap or a sock or a mouthwash or a bubble gum, it's still more casual and authentic in that environment versus somebody overthinking their feelings about something in a survey or focus group.
I'm keen to quickly pick up on something you mentioned. The social dilemma has obviously caused a lot of conversations around how people use social media. It's risen consumer awareness of how they're being targeted, how their data is being used. Do you think, what are the outcomes you expect from this? Are there positive outcomes such as people being more, attempting to be more authentic or be more aware of how they are maybe being influenced and make more decisive choices or?
No, I actually have a very different point of view. I'm a little bit worried about it because what I'm seeing is that people are blaming platforms for their own bad behavior. What I'm seeing is the things like Social Dilemma continue to build momentum on the greatest virus in society, which is lack of accountability. It's a lot more fun to blame an algorithm than to blame yourself. And what I've seen, personally, one man's point of view, is that the added awareness has now made people decide to point at something else. I tell my friends, I'm like, look, because you can imagine every friend of mine that isn't in this industry always wants to talk to me about this, especially with kids and things of that nature. I'm like, look, Gary, this is ruining our kids. I'm like, you're their parent. Don't let them be on the platform. But you don't get it. I'm like, of course I do get it. I am so happy in my life because my mother created an ecosystem that didn't make me succumb to peer pressure and allow me to independently think and to not have my self-esteem wrapped up in other people's validation. I'm exactly the person that gets it. You as a parent are making a decision that you actually don't care about this as much as you claim you do because you're letting your child live on it and you yourself are living on it. So just my concern is that the conversation has led to even more blame, even less accountability. And I genuinely believe accountability is an incredible key to happiness. And I think we've lived through, man, at this point, a generation of avoidance around accountability.
Is that, so you're talking about personal accountability. What about business accountability? Because I guess it'd be good to get your point of view as someone that runs an advertising agency. What's the responsibility as an advertising agency in terms of?
I think that every woman and man that runs one, because it's theirs or theirs to choose, has the freedoms to make decisions on what their moral compass and what their belief system is. I think it's extremely dangerous for us to say this is the responsibility of any business owner gets into the audacity that has led us to a lot of unrest in our society where people literally believe they think they know better. To me, the reality is that what I like about the world is that I believe the world has consequences. I genuinely do. You know, what I don't admire is people being keyboard warriors or pontificating, but then don't act on it. So, you know, for example, there are many clients that we don't take on. There are many decisions I make that are completely based on how I see the world. And I try to live the world and try to live my life in a way that makes me feel good about it. You know, when I was doing an NFT project, I spent a lot of time looking at the environmental headlines because I was scared. Am I wrong? Is this going to be bad? You know, I think we're all going through it. And I'm sure there's agencies, for example, that won't take on Pepsi and Coca-Cola because they have sugar beverages and plastic. Others are okay with that one, but not okay with a gun manufacturer, or might not be good with an oil and fossil, or might not be good with an, like, you know, from my point of view, I think one of the real vulnerabilities of society right now is judgment. Now, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't hold people accountable, because we can. And I think that there's, you know, where I'm concerned is there are certain things that are so egregious that you will get such substantial consent that, like, hey, what are you doing? I think where we're struggling right now is when you have some issues as an agency owner where, you know, 50% of the people think one thing and 50% of the people think another thing. That becomes quite a challenge. And for me, if an organization, if BBDO or Wyden or Hey KQA decide this and we decide the other way, I don't think I'm a better person. I don't think I'm a worse person. I'm genuinely waking up every day trying to do good things to the best of my ability. And so for me, I think that everybody should aspire to be kind and make good decisions. The world is a complicated place with a lot of layered, you know, nuances to everything. And I think we're all learning every single day. Things I know about today or things I never thought I would ever think about, the energy that a server outputted against the proof of work or proof of stake of an NFT. But, you know, you do the best you can and you make the decisions you can. And I think everybody plays a different. I'll give you an example. My parents raised me in a manner where most of my nonprofit behavior is quite private, much to the chagrin of many of the people on the receiving end or my own people around me, because they're like, you got to build this up. You got to talk about it more. I'm not comfortable with that. But I don't think that means that somebody who makes a big to-do about every check they donate means that they're a bad person. That's what they're comfortable with. In the same way that I'm comfortable spewing all over LinkedIn and interviews like this, my deeply passionate counterpoint to views, you know, whereas somebody else would never want to do that. And so I think that's how I see those kind of questions, Jess.
Yeah, I guess it comes down to kind of owning your point of view, and it comes back to the accountability that you talk about, you know, as long as you're holding yourself accountable as a business owner, as a
And I encourage my employees and others that if you're not happy with the decisions that your client or customer are making. What's amazing is you have the freedom of choice in most places in the world to not work there anymore. We have, you know, I'm, you know, just publicly, I'm pretty socially liberal, but I have some employees that are, you know, and they come in with some asks sometimes that are so impossible to achieve. And I love my employees. So I'm like pretty in the game. Like I like to go there, but occasionally once a year, not only that much, but once a year, sometimes I have to go to the line that I never want to, which is like, look, I'll make pretend to you, Jess, we're as far as we can go on this. And like, I think you're amazing and I want you to be here. But if you need us to replace all our desks with clouds and I can't do that for you, two things. One, I'd be incredibly inclined to like help you with your next chapter. And I'd also equally beg you to like, please realize this is a very aggressive ask that most places are not going to be able to achieve. I think we have to have more conversations like that in general, because I think ideology versus practicality is where things get into a little bit of trouble.
Okay, interesting. I want to quickly bring us back because I know, go on.
But I will say this, Jess, for everybody who's a leader who's watching, and there's a lot of leaders, I am petrified to look back at a decision with regret through the eyes of my children or grandchildren. And that is always how I decide. Now, that might not be good enough for somebody else because they've got a different point of view, but I've never picked financial short-term decision-making over long-term brand vulnerability. Who wants to be on the wrong side of history?
Yeah.
It doesn't sound
but
attractive.
I guess what is the wrong side of history? That changes so often.
So often, which is why, to your point, you've said that. So for me, that's why I'm like, look, I'm going to make the best decision I can make right now with the data that's in front of me. Try to use what's always worked for me, because that's why I've been innovative. Try to use a little bit of chess moves to understand where the temperature may be.
Yeah.
And take it from there.
Great. I want to bring us back. There's lots more I want to discuss. I'm conscious of time. If we're coming back to that attention, you know, measuring attention and how to capture users' attention, you've talked in the past at past events about how real people often will just do anything to avoid watching an ad. So that might be fast forwarding through it, might be leaving the room when it's playing, whatever it might be. So how do you assign value in that world when, you know, if users are really trying to avoid being interrupted or having to sit through something that they haven't chosen, how do you measure kind of attention and value in that environment?
The same way we answered earlier, Jess. I spend zero time trying to solve a problem that's unsolvable. Until you allow me to put chips in everybody's brain, Jess, and see all the information, which then leads me into the place of common sense. It is absolutely my belief that people do not want commercials and pop-up banner ads on websites.
Yeah.
I don't believe that. What that then leads me to is, why do you think I was so attracted to social media? The native nature of the feed was so much less disruptive. And if you were able then to do native creative that actually somehow brought value to the other person on the other side, you were able to then get results. And I'm basically in that same general place. How do I make, if I make a pre-roll YouTube ad based on people's search query, I know what they're searching. I know they're about to watch something else. But I know they like skiing, even though they're gonna watch this how to fix a car video. So I'm gonna show them skiing content. How do I not make it an ad? Like, why can't it be something informational or something deeply entertaining, not a spoof of a music video, but an actual music video? How do I do that? And I think that's the game that I spend a lot of time on. And so that becomes the number one driver for me. And so I don't worry about how to measure. I worry about how to make output that is actually something somebody wants. And I genuinely believe that 98% of the work in the world is stuff that people don't want. I genuinely believe that. That is not a dig at my own shop, because we put out plenty of things that I don't believe customers want. And even though I, you know, I have to be empathetic. There's only so much dictatorship I can drive through my company. You know, you have to be empathetic. But I've been pushing harder the last 6 months. I'm like, team, we have to make things. And it's funny, we've started to really move the needle in that direction. And we've felt the effects of that with work recently. And, you know, it's great for me because it's affirmation for a direction I'm trying to push on. I'm like, look, people don't want a 30-second spot. They don't want a branded piece of content as a social media post. We have to make stuff that people want. And that's how I wake up every day. Like, I come to this interview not thinking about what I want to say. I'm trying to listen to you to see where you want me to go, because you have a sense of what you're curious about or what you think your audience might be curious about. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about them. They're busy. All of you are busy. I know you are. So you've taken time out here. How can I say something that may bring them value? Because what's interesting for me in the agency and brand ecosystem is I think the world's abundant. So if OMD wins a piece of business that we didn't, or Droga or 72 and Sunny or Dentsu Group, like, I don't, you know, of course I want to win everything we're involved in, but I come to an interview like this, so I'm not looking to hold back, because A, most people can't execute on the things I believe in anyway, because it's not culturally or structurally that way. And B, if they do, that makes me happy, because if it's good for them, that's just karma and good. And I think in general, that empathy and compassion that I have for my potential competition is something I'm asking the industry to do for the consumer on the other side of the creative. Like, are we really in this audacious place that we think the world is sitting with bated breath to see our ad so they can buy our thing?
It's audacious. You talk about how you've been pushing in the last 6 months, I'm interested to hear how, if you've been pushing in the last 6 months to really create ads that you think that consumers want, how do you do that while balancing that volume-based creative that you're well known for?
Well, our volume-based creative is performing even better than the ads I'm talking to you about, because inherently our biggest strength is contextual, social, creative to the platform for the user in mind. One of the reasons we're able to do that, Jess, is because people in the ad world don't take social media branding content as serious. That part's actually very easy, as long as we do a good job training and casting our own team and they don't get into bad behaviors of other agencies or what they think it should be. And that place is actually the place, Jess, that has allowed us to grow into more of a creative AOR for a lot of people. The success of that work in many of our buildings, to the point where it's like, you know, we did something very smart. We wanted to be held accountable. Give us the media and the creative and social. We'll show you a business result. All of a sudden, Mr. Peanut, Miracle Whip, like, they're looking around and like, why is this work? I mean, there's, you know, you can imagine for me as someone who's pushing it in a different direction, watching somebody go from genuinely thinking I'm full of crap to 9 months later being stunned that their business is moving for the first time in a while. And by the way, just most of the opportunities we get to do our thing are almost inherently always brands that are in big trouble, because they view what we do as high risk or left field or different. So usually when we get called in is after six creative shops have had an at-bat and it's still declining. And they're like, let's take the crazy guy that we heard on the podcast, you know? And that's been our growth, and it's going well, and I'm proud of it. So we don't see quantity as a barrier to quality. We see quantity as an opportunity for high impact. And so we also come with compassion. I'm imagining right now a lot of creative directors or creatives on the other side watching this. I understand and respect why quantity is frowned upon. I really do. The craft, the work. I genuinely understand. On the flip side, I can tell you that we have a stable of incredible creative directors that come from all the fancy places that are having the most fun in their career because they're finally being creative and getting ideas into the world.
But But I think this is the last question that we've got time for, but I just want to understand, and maybe you can kind of provide advice to everyone who's listening, because you've talked about volume, you've talked about pushing the quality of your work in the past 6 months, but you also have talked in the past about how you can offer high volumes of content for very low margins, and that's, again, why brands come to you and you're getting more AORs. How are you able to do all of that? Low margins, high quality creative, high volume.
This versus this. Let me explain. So we build a triangle operational system. The reason our quality creative is working is because we're native to the platform. You know, we're producing a TikTok that will get 21 million views for less money than the catering bill on a shoot of a commercial that will take 8 months to go from ideation to market. We also build triangles. What do I mean by that? We have clients who maybe last year paid 7 million for an AOR and now are paying us 4, who have 31 people on their business instead of 7. Why? Because our concept is to make, and we have a lot of creators, incredible creative designers. We're also the production of that work within our creative department. Remember, one of the great challenges in my career, Jess, has been to take incredible creatives from other shops and educate them on context and nuances of social. Right? So we have truly strategic and creative experts in how to make a TikTok do well, in how to make an Instagram do well, which, as you can imagine, I'm sure makes sense to you and everybody on this call, is a different skill set than a 22-year vet who's a creative director, who's really incredible at writing a script, ideating creative ideas, working hand in hand with a tremendous strategist to pitch an incredible idea, right? They're just different. So, as you know, because we have creative AOR clients, and some of our clients push us to be far more classic than I prefer, even after we speak with them and I speak with them. It costs a lot of money to have a great strategy team and a great creative team spend 8 to 12 weeks before they even present to you, Jessica, the brand manager or CMO. Then the feedback, right? It's another month. You didn't love it as much. We have to go back. We come back. Now you made a subjective call that you like it. Oh, let's throw it into an Ipsos test. There's another 2 weeks. Oh, now let's go shoot it. Oh, we've got a triple bit of production company. Right? Oh, you know what? We need a fancy director. This is our brand anthem video. By the time that fancy director comes, who's always got plenty of ego and confidence on her or his mind too, you got the brand manager, you got the creative director, you've got the production company, you've got the fancy director. What you're ending up with is what I call vanilla Frankenstein. By nature, because it's going to go through broad market, it's got to be vanilla because it's trying to reach too many people. It's Frankenstein because 4 very important people have all tried to plug in their point of view on this 30-second video. And then it's being distributed in traditional distribution that is getting far less consumption than, is anybody not paying attention to how much consumption is going on OTT? Truly a network television commercial? It's a very big challenge. And that's to Asia, that's to America, that's to every part of the world. And so the reason we're able to do it is I believe that the creative industry inherently is slow and expensive. We flipped it upside down. We get 8 out of 10 people saying no because they think that down here it's not brand work. They don't even realize how much brand work's happening in social. They, to your point, Jess, will think that is quantity bad? Like, that's not good. How is this on? And then my favorite one, how is every piece of content on brand without realizing that on brand is a boardroom discussion far more than it is a consumer discussion? I think the world is missing on relevance and consideration. And I think the cost of entry is far more output, meaningful output. But I really believe that. And I think over time we'll be historically correct.
Gary, thank you so much. This is all we have time for. I wish we could continue to solve the world's problems. But
another time.
Thank you very much. Thank you to Advertising Week Asia for having us. My name's Jessica Goodfellow. I'm at Campaign Asia, and Gary Vaynerchuk, he needs no introduction. So thank you very much.
As we end today's podcast, I want to give a huge shout out to the people. You know, it's so funny. People that leave reviews and written reviews of this podcast on Apple, Spotify, and all the other platforms just mean the world to me. You've taken an extra 13 to 95 seconds to show love and also give context to people of why this is a worthwhile podcast. So I appreciate that so much. And even more fun, because I think we all love a little cosign or a shout out or a little awareness, I'm going to have the team give a couple of shout outs daily on our favorite reviews. So take it away. Which were our favorites this week?
Thanks, Gary. Today's amazing five-star review comes from Charlie Harvey R, and it reads, I've listened to 500 plus hours of Gary V, and he's politely asked me to leave him a review 500 plus times. Finally, I'm doing it. I'm a 50-year-old lawyer who loves listening to his wisdom. Gratitude, provide value, love the process, honesty, patience. He inspires me every single morning. I sometimes imagine asking him a question, but because I've listened carefully for so long, I already know what he would say. I listen while running on a treadmill, and I always have a new idea by the end of the run. When I want to be extra entrepreneurial, I put on his shoes. Thank you, Gary. Thank you so much, Charlie. We're so glad you find so much value from this podcast, and we're very thankful that you decided to leave us a review after 500 plus hours of Gary. That's dedication. Thank you so much. And to anybody else out there, if you're listening, if you leave us a review like Charlie did, you might just get shouted out in the next episode.